It is a common delusion in religion to believe that rituals and chanting will do all the work, purifying the soul without comparable emphasis on attitude and on inner communion with God. Paramahansa Yogananda used to say that meditation is to religion what experimentation and the laboratory is to science. Without it, results are haphazard and unsatisfactory at best. I was a part of the New Age scene of those days, though I remained on the outskirts of it. Perhaps some people identified me with one setting or another. I sought in all those expressions of God's play the role He wanted me specifically to play. I remember one evening sitting on the stage of a large auditorium with Swami Bhaktivedanta, Allen Ginsberg, and other leading lights in the New Age movement. We chanted for and with hundreds of young people, while lights played erratically on the walls, floor, and ceiling, as well as on the audience, which swayed to a heavy beat of its own that rocked the very walls. This, too, was an expression of God's play, but how many saw it as such? The noise and chaos created a wall around each of those hundreds of egos. I remember another evening also when I and two well-known teachers from India were on a dais before a room full of devotees. The scene was a kind of reenactment of the devotional play between guru and earnest disciples, the latter teasingly asking questions, to which the teachers replied, again teasingly, out of their, quote, wisdom. A pleasant spirit of camaraderie pervaded the room. It wasn't the game of one-upmanship one so often encounters when different teachers are in a room together. Too much of the banter, however, came from an attitude of, "Oh, wise ones, grant us enlightenment." I was uncomfortable in this role. This isn't for me, I thought. I'm interested in sharing with others, not in being looked up to by them. I was often exposed to this sort of situation, but did all I could to emphasize that the spiritual teacher's role is to serve others, not to be served by them. My great guru set this example, and was great especially in his self-effacement before the greatness of God. At one such event, I found myself seated on a stage with teachers from various traditions, Hindu, Christian, Jewish, Sufi, Sikh, all of us seated in a row, like crows on a fence, as I later commented to friends, before a full auditorium. Most of those up there with me displayed only one aim, to be heard. For myself, unless I was asked to speak, I remained silent. I felt as much out of it as, to borrow a phrase from the British humorist P.G. Woodhouse, a cat at a dog show. Finally, seizing a moment when everyone's eyes were closed, I sneaked out to a nearby restaurant where a good friend, Jay Levin, whom I later gave the name Prahlad, and I had a good meal. This was, I learned, his birthday. And so went all my attempts at finding a niche, toward failure and alienation, not toward discovering new peers and new ways to serve God. A song of mine expressed my feelings at the time. I've passed my life as a stranger, Lord, roamed far in foreign lands, far, Lord, far too far. Only he who knows he's far from home, only he, Lord, understands. Only he who knows he's far from home feels the earth and understands. Sometimes a stranger did take me in, then love I thought was near. Love, Lord, only a dream, as the winds upon the desert sand whisper hope, then disappear. As soft winds breathe on the desert sand, so love sighs, then disappears. Sometimes a child laughed, and I did pause, and dreamed of joys at home. Joys, Lord, only a dream. For what joy is there without your smile, empty like the ocean foam? For what joy is there without your smile? You're the sea, all else is foam. Let me sing the last stanza. How long must I be a wanderer, Lord? You know where I belong. You know, Lord, yes, you know. Home is where my Lord's sweet presence is. I've grown tired of strangers' songs. Home is where my Lord's sweet presence is. Bless me that I hear your songs. Those were not easy years for me. I had no spiritual bodyguard, as Master described the company of fellow monks for protection. Environment, he used to say, is stronger than willpower. I was stubborn in my discipleship to him and in my daily meditations, but most of the people I met considered me an unknown quantity. I wanted to reach and help everyone, whether of or not of the world. I was trying to attune myself to their needs and attitudes in order to awaken them to their spiritual nature. Outwardly, I appeared more or less like others, dressing as a swami only for special events. Many women, not unnaturally, saw in me their natural prey. I remember one attractive lady emerging into the living room of her home from its inner apartment during my visit there. Completely naked, she chased me about the room until I finally managed to make good my escape. Women were, however, again, not unnaturally a temptation for me. Or perhaps I should say that what attracted me in them was their feminine energy. Basically, that energy, kind, compassionate, embracing, is a manifestation of the Divine Mother principle, which is untainted by ego motive. I was as yet unable, however, to rise above a longing for human love, and I had nowhere to run for protection. The only solution, it seemed to me, was to keep loading the other side of the scales with devotion and with service to God in others. Master had once told one of my brother monks, "I don't ask you to overcome delusion. All I ask is that you resist it." Inner resistance was, I eventually discovered, a matter of, even mentally, withholding water from the plant. After years of sometimes despairing effort, I saw the fulfillment of my guru's promise. By his grace, that energy ceased to hold any appeal for me. Divine love, I realized, is all-sufficient to the heart's needs, and is moreover free from egoic limitation. In its human expression, on the other hand, sweetness and compassion can turn just as easily to vicious rage and vindictiveness, like the moods of Mother Nature herself. The good side during those days for me was that yoga was in, and there were many who wanted to learn it. The competitive aspect hadn't yet entered the picture. There was a spirit of sharing, less of appealing to people's egos from the ego. The hard edge of so much of what passes for yoga nowadays was less in evidence. People seemed relatively open to the deeper and more devotional aspects of this spiritual science. I remember a lady in Sacramento who enrolled the second time around in my meditation course. "When I took these classes the first time," she confided in me, "I was interested only in the yoga postures. I thought they'd make a good conversation piece for my weekly bridge club. But, you know, this stuff's serious. I want to learn more about it." And so people came for a variety of reasons. More and more, however, they sought guidance in their inner life. Even that exuberant Lady Godiva, having finally found herself a husband, became a devotee and sometimes visited Ananda after it was built.